Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to New Books Network. I am your hostess with the mostest, Dr. Lee Pierce, rhetorician, today amateur comedian as well, and I'm excited to welcome Jack Black, who is the author of a new book out of Routledge titled Race, Racism, and Political Correctness in Comedy. In what ways is comedy subversive? This vital new book critically considers the importance of comedy in challenging and redefining our relations to race and racism through the lens of political correctness. By viewing comedy as both a constitutive feature of social interaction and as a necessary requirement in the appraisal of what is often deemed to be politically correct, this book provides an innovative and multidisciplinary approach to the study of comedy and political culture and popular culture. In doing so, it engages with the social and cultural tensions inherent to our understandings of political correctness, arguing that comedy can be subversively redefined in our approach to PC debates, contestation surrounding free speech, and the popular portrayal of political correctness in the media and in society. This book draws on psychoanalysis, social psychology, philosophy, all the greats, and will be highly relevant for all kinds of listeners. So I hope you enjoy the interview, learn a little bit more about the British office. You're going to hear a lot of swear words. And now I'd like to turn it over to Jack, who is a senior lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. Jack, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah,
all right. How'd I do with Hallam?
Yeah, you got there. Yeah.
Hey,
yeah,
Hallam. All right.
Hallam. That sounds good.
Well, tell us about yourself. Tell us about the book. How'd you come to write it? Why do you love comedy? Why'd you choose The Office and not some other TV show as your case study? And what's the deal with psychoanalysis and how that is why'd you choose that lens and not many others that were available to you?
Yeah, brilliant. No, thank you. I think quite interesting there. You picked up on sort of two themes, the sort of psychoanalysis aspect and then also the comedy aspect. I think I sound a bit daft saying this, but because I'm meant to be talking about my book, but if there was, I think there was one book which sort of inspired the approach I take in this one, and that's Alenka Supanjit's book, Comedy, the Odd One In. And it was while reading that, obviously she's a well-known Lacanian psychoanalyst, and it was while reading that and her thoughts on comedy that I then started to think about a particular episode from when I was younger, and I do remember it. I remember watching The Office when I was younger, and there was a particular episode one, season two, which centres around the telling of a black man's cock joke. And I remember at the time, thinking about issues of racism and whatnot, I thought there was something about that joke that always stuck with us, and I was always laughing about it. And it was only obviously later that you go on to study these sort of issues that you tend to sort of start to draw the links between them. So it was the coming together really of both an interest in psychoanalysis, especially when applied to popular culture and the media, and then also Alenka Supanjit's book on comedy, where I started to sort of bring these things together. And I suppose it's an odd one. Well, it's an odd one in the sense that I'm sort of, I remember being a fan of The Office when I was younger. It's an odd one to watch now. And I've never seen the US one as well, which is probably sacrilege to those in the US. But I think it was drawing those things together, which was where the interest for the book come from.
Well, and the British office, and I don't know if everyone knows this, but just to be clear, there was a British office before there was an American office. It's only, I think, two seasons and a special, and it is Ricky Gervais. So it's not nearly as like long in duration as the American office. And so a lot of people who maybe came to the office recently don't know there was ever a British version. But I think what was notable, and the reason why it's a really important text for this book, is that British comedy had not translated well to the US for a long time, right? There were some hits like with Monty Python, but generally speaking, that awkward, what they call situational comedy had just not transferred over. And then you started to see Meet the Fockers and the British Office start to really pick up in the US. And now you see much more of that situational absurdist comedy. So in some ways, it's the best text to analyze because it really transcended comedy barriers in ways that previous sitcoms had not been able to.
Yeah, well, I think that was, I mean, I don't know where he said, because they did The Office, him and Stephen Merchant, and then they did Extras, which was on HBO, I think. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? You get that link. HBO helped make it alongside the BBC. And essentially what was Extras, apart from a load of well-known, you know, American and British celebrities making fun of themselves. So I think it's interesting that, I suppose, yeah, the success of these shows sort of followed that, really. But yeah, I mean, The Office was unique in that respect. Yeah, I mean, it sort of gave birth to what we often refer to as the sort of mockumentary style, where it's sort of filmed as a documentary and it's hard to tell, you know, very similar to like reality TV as well at the time. So it had that sort of documentary feel, but was, I suppose, the only thing that had previously done that would be Spinal Tap or something.
Which was also British.
Also British, which was interesting. And I think that's what something that made it quite interesting and quite unique at the time. It's probably been a bit overdone now.
Yeah, and it's lost. And what you point out, and we'll get to this a little bit later, we should probably do some theory, but what you point out is the way that Gervais uses the camera to cue the satire, which has stopped, right? That's, I think, what made that show really special. And you don't see it in some of, like, Parks and Recreation. You don't see it in some of these other mockumentary styles in the same way as you saw it in Spinal Tap. Because that cue is important, because without the cue, a joke is just something, it's just a statement. And with the cue, it's performative, right? And that changes how you have to read it. So I think this is an important thing you pick up on as you analyze the joke. Okay, so, but before we get to the Office joke, which is awesome, let's roll back. And essentially what you say in the book overall is that you're going to use psychoanalytic concepts to look at ways that comedy can subversively challenge our universal notions. And you say, by seeking to establish a deliberate sense of uncomfortableness as fundamental to our relations with the other and ourselves. And then you say that obviously part of this is going to be this kind of hegemonic understanding of political correctness, as it kind of sometimes enables, but more often suppresses discomfort as a necessary part of like our collective belonging. So can you unpack some of that and then maybe roll into some of the psychoanalysis you think we'll need for the book?
Yeah, definitely. To sort of follow up with what you said there, I think one of the reasons why I was drawn to psychoanalysis, and it's, I think it's something that's interesting in particular about authors such as Alenka Supanjic, Slavoj Žižek, is that what they do is they take Lacan's ideas from psychoanalysis and they sort of they link them to sort of philosophical debates and philosophical contentions. So I think one of the things that sort of sits behind both Supanjic and Žižek is their dialectical materialism. So what we mean by that is essentially what they're doing is looking for those inconsistencies in reality itself. And I think that's what made comedy as subversive quite unique, in the sense that comedy as a form of subversion might be something that's very good at identifying these sort of inconsistencies or the gaps and the contradictions in our sort of universal assumptions, but also in ideological notions as well. So it was sort of linking those two together that I thought, you know, in what ways can comedy be subversive, and in what ways can I perhaps carry on the ideas that Supanjic raises in her book on comedy as well. And she draws upon the work of Hegel, and in particular, she has this wonderful example, this sort of thought experiment, which sort of, as I said, sort of once I heard this sort of example, it was really where the idea for the book sort of came from. But she talks about the Baron slipping on a banana peel. So I'll just quickly read it because it makes a bit more sense once I've read it. So she says, a toffee-nosed Baron slips on a banana peel, thus demonstrating that even he is subject to the laws of gravity. Yet the next instant, he is up again and walking around arrogantly, no less sure of the highness of his highness, until the next accident that will again try to ground him, and so on and so on. And I think what's quite interesting here is Supanjic draws a whole theory of comedy from this example. What she says is she makes these two distinctions. She says there's true comedy and there's false comedy. Now, the false comedy is the very conservative attitude that the Baron slips on the banana peel, gets up and carries on. And in that moment of slippage, he's human like everybody else. So this is the idea that you could take somebody like a Baron and they could make themselves look a bit like a tit. And then we carry on as normal. So they carry it. They're just like anybody else, because anybody can do that. And that would be the sort of the false comedy there. So she often refers to that as a very conservative form. You saw this a lot with George Bush, who deliberately made himself look a bit daft and a bit silly, and as part of his image. What's this strange? You have that strange thing in America. What is it? The White House dinner?
The White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah, it's an opportunity. I'm just like you guys. I might be the president of America, but you know, I can make a joke and laugh at myself.
You know, that's a really good argument. You should write an essay on that. I've never heard anyone argue that the White House Correspondents' Dinner actually preserves a conservative sense of false comedy. That's genius.
Well, I don't know if I made that. I'm probably doing what all good people. I'm stealing that. I think the example I draw upon, I think this example, it might be from Zabanja, but I think Todd McGowan in his book on comedy makes that link as well.
I haven't read McGowan's book. I need to.
Right. Well, that's another one. I'm just going to tell you to read other books. And not my own. It's the best place to start. But yeah, I think he makes that. But it's a very conservative link. I mean, Boris Johnson would be the perfect UK example of somebody who does that. You know, acts a bit daft and a bit silly. And it works, doesn't it? Because you end up getting elected president or prime minister. But this idea that if you look at the Baron when he falls in on the banana peel and laugh because he's just like every other human being, there's something gone wrong there, and that's a false form of comedy. The true form, and I think this is where Zapanjic's argument is utterly fantastic, is this idea that true comedy occurs when the universal, in both its abstract and actual dimensions, is brought together in a particular concrete example that provides a short circuit between the universal and the concrete. So I think essentially what she's arguing there is it's that you don't laugh at the Baron because he's human. You laugh at the presumptuous way that the Baron stands up and carries on acting like a Baron. So you're laughing at his barrenness, the title itself, this symbolic identity. The fact that somebody could believe in their symbolic identity is where the comedy lies, not within the way it makes everybody the same and everybody human. You're laughing at this symbolic, ideological, this universal notion of barrenness, which is made to look ridiculous in the moment of him slipping on the banana peel. So he looks like an idiot in that moment when he does so. And there's a wonderful, in the book I link this with, there's a fantastic example from the British comedy series Only Fools and Horses, where the character Del falls through a bar. So he's with his friend in a bar and he's trying to chat up. There's a girl in the bar as well, and he's trying to, attract her attention. And he's talking to his friend Trigger at the time. And he's saying, look, this is how you go about attracting a woman. This is what women want. And then little does he know, as he stands up saying this, someone goes through the countertop of the bar, lifts up the countertop. He then goes back to lean against the bar and he falls through the bar. It's called the Del Falls Through a Bar scene. So if you stick it in YouTube, you'll get it. And it's probably one of the most, it'll probably get voted the funniest scene, I think, in British comedy. And I think it's very similar to the slip and the banana peel there. It's not that Del's just like everybody else. I think there's a subversive element in that, and that what you can actually criticize is Del's image of his masculinity. It's the fact that he knows as a man what women want. And I think that's what you're meant to be laughing at there. That's the subversive element in it. Fun of the symbolic identity.
There's a really good piece of stand-up I watched recently that I didn't... So I've never found Kevin Hart very funny. Do you know who Kevin Hart is?
Yes, yeah.
Have never gone in... Not, he's not bad. He's adorable. I just never really got into him. And then there was that... And this gets us to political correctness, which is that in 2011, he made some really homophobic tweets that got him removed as the host of the Oscars. And a lot of people thought it was unfair. And then I watched this skit called Gun Compartment, where he performs masculinity. And not only is he performing it very, like, to break, right? So there's a universal sense of what a man does to protect his home, right? That's very entrenched. And then there's the specific, obvious impossibility that any person could ever live up to that universal. And he performs this contradiction so well in this joke. And part of what he does is he breaks. So you know how comedians are supposed to keep a straight face and not laugh at their own jokes? He really strategically uses the break. And it's such an effective, I was really impressed because I just don't see very many people do this well.
No, yeah. Well, it's dangerous because you got to play
right Yeah.
You've got to play the masculinity, haven't
right.
you? And I think this is what made me, you know, when I read this example of the baron, you know, it's still a baron. It's still, obviously, go back to the Sopranos example there. It's still that which you're meant to be laughing at. And I thought, well, in the context of a racist joke, like how far could you go with a racist joke?
That's right.
Before it subverts itself, before, in exactly the same way you're talking there about Kevin Hart, how far do you go with this masculine example where that sort of, where it starts to untie itself, where in its own performance you see its inconsistency and the gaps within it.
Right.
And that's where the moment of subversion. I mean, there's a whole debate to be had here. I mean, I know there are authors, particularly psychoanalytic authors, who would probably say that's more a path of perversion, and subversion is perversion.
Right,
so I think, and that's something that I probably could have discussed a bit more in the book. But I think it's an interesting debate to have, because I think comedy gives us a space where you can subvert in that sense, if that makes sense, more so than perhaps, other aspects.
Well, speaking of books that neither one of us wrote, I have an interview coming out shortly with Josh Gunn, who talks about the difference between good perversion and mean perversion. So playful perversion and mean perversion. So this may be a solution, because there are comics who point out, like Bill Burr, I think in the US is one of them.
Yeah, Bill Burr.
He points out contradictions all the time. I think he has this line in a stand-up where he says, he's basically saying, like, I don't want to hear any more white women bitch about how hard their life was unless your uncle banged you in the dirt.
Yes.
And so in a weird way, he's acknowledging intersectionality, which is a thing he usually makes fun of, because he is saying, like, different kinds of oppression enable, like, should authorize you to have more legitimacy to your complaints. But he doesn't do it in a way that upends the universal particular, right? It's too particular.
Yes.
So it doesn't subvert the relationship. It just reinforces it, because it ignores the universal and goes straight to the specific. So even comedians that have done it don't do it well, because they're mean perverts, as God would say.
Well, definitely. And I think it's something we can come on to talk about a bit later, perhaps in the joke itself. And I think it's the position. It's not just the content. It's the form. It's the it's the position, the subject of enunciation. Yep. But it's also the position of what something's being said, and it's how it's being said as well. Which is really, which is interesting, I think. And I think that's where it goes good and where it goes bad, perhaps, when it gets lost. So I think in that sense, you know, if you're just, you know, the example you just gave there, I mean, this is the problem I have with, like, I don't find them funny. And I remember being at university and everybody, like, saying how funny John Oliver and...
Oh, John Oliver,
And who was the one who used to do the date? Is it the Daily Show?
John Stewart.
John Stewart. That was the one. But I don't know, because they end up being talking from the universal position,
aren't they?
Where they can laugh at white working class, they can laugh at black working class, they can laugh at the rich and everything. And I think, you know, that's something that I hope the book would criticize,
because I think
that's bad perversion, because then you're just you're getting off on the joke, you know, having that position of the almighty and being able to comment on everybody else, which is
So how does this get us to political correctness then? Because in theory, you could have made the whole argument of the book, it would have been a different book, but you could have just dumped the political correctness angle and really just looked at how does comedy subvert or not subvert the universal particular, right? That could have been the question. And instead, you really want to look at this through a lens of the move toward political correctness, which enriches the book and nuances it. So why go there? What's the argument there? What do you think it adds to the book?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the influence from reading probably far too much Slavoj Žižek. But this is interesting, because I think, obviously, Žižek's very critical of liberal multiculturalism. And as I said, I think as soon as I read that Baron example from Supanjic, it was straight away I was thinking of the example of David Brent from the joke that we'll consider in a bit. And I knew then that was clearly, you know, David Brent was a character who thought he was performing political correctness. And I think that's what gave that character a particular angle. You know, he thought he was the liberal postmodern boss who was friends with everybody. You know, don't call me boss, call me David type thing. And I think that's the way I sort of then started to think about the way in which liberal multiculturalism, and in particular political correctness, had taken on this position of universality, this sort of false universal position. It was a particular that was proclaiming itself as the universal position, because what it so often did is that it allowed the liberal individual to donate his money to the refugee crisis, make sure that the food banks stocked up and whatnot, but all the while never actually changing his own position, so he could maintain that universal position. And this was at the time, I mean, I wrote the book in in summer 2019. And this was on the back of like a refugee crisis, obviously, in Europe, where we had like people like Bob Geldof, you know, saying that a refugee can come live in my house. We've got a football, we've got an ex-footballer who's now a pundit, who's sort of like a television presenter, Gary Lineker, who invites a refugee to come and live with him. And it's that, you know, it's that they can't, well, you can do that, Gary, probably because you live in a house with like 30 rooms. You know what I mean? It's like,
right. It's like your house is a hotel, it's like the neoconservative politicians who have like 9 foster kids, but then won't stand up for basic human rights for foster kids. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, I think that was one way of drawing all this together. And I said, I always had the office at the back of my mind. I think that was one thing that got me thinking along the lines there of political correctness and liberal multiculturalism. And it was a way, I think in particular, a lot of the examples I draw upon in the book from television and whatnot were all in some way linked to political correctness. They were all taking the mick out of political correctness or highlighting how political correctness could perhaps be used in that false perverted sense of which you mentioned earlier. And I think, I mean, you mentioned it before. I mean, there's the example from Dead to Me, I think, which highlights, I think, some of the inconsistencies in that.
Yeah, and this is an argument you make in the book. Do you want to read the Dead to Me joke, or do you want me to? Because I did write it down.
Oh well, no, yeah, you're the comedian. You say it.
No, I'm not. I'm not very good though. Yeah. If I were, I'd be doing comedy shows, not book interviews. Yeah. But maybe I'd do both. Who knows? So you do say that the real. Kind of like the one of the sentences I zoomed in on in this book is that the real, I don't know if it's what you want to say, like the best comedy does, when comedy is kind of working in support of subversion, I guess that's the way to say it. When it's being subversive is that it exaggerates the inherent contradictions in political correctness. So I thought that was a great takeaway is like, okay, this is how we do, or between true and false, like mean-spirited and playful perversion, right? However you want to use your theory. Right? At the base, it's about there's an inherent contradiction in this thing that we all kind of revere or tiptoe around or talk about as if it's just one monolithic thing, like political correctness. But there are inherent contradictions, and the comedian's job is to point out those contradictions, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. So it's like the comedy that you can share with your best friend. So your best friend knows all about you.
Yeah.
And they can say the things that nobody else can say.
Right.
And it's funny, if you know what I mean. Perhaps an ex-boyfriend, girlfriend, or something or other, and it's that, or it's like something your mum or your dad might say to you, and that's. So it's that having that relationship with somebody where they can say the worst things possible, but it's funny.
Well, and this is a really good point because when comedians say shitty stuff, and I think Ricky Gervais is a really good example. He has a stand-up, and the very opening bit is a very long joke about Caitlyn Jenner, who is a trans woman.
Yes.
The joke does not point out, it starts out by pointing out an inherent contradiction in the way that sort of we all say like, oh, we have to be totally politically correct around trans identity. He really early gets at the inherent contradiction, which I thought was great. I wish he just stopped there because then the remaining 10 minutes of the joke, it's just repeated transphobia and dead naming Caitlyn Jenner with zero benefit. And so you see very swiftly the switch from, look, I'm a comedian who points out a contradiction y'all haven't seen in this thing you think is so important to you, but you're not critically analyzing it. Two, now I'm just going to be a mean pervert and just mock trans people, right? So you can really see the difference.
He does that from the point of science a lot, doesn't he? I've noticed that.
Yes.
He'll always like resort to
science.
As if, and then take the mick out of religion as if, you know, it's not difficult, is it, to take the mick out of religion, Ricky? Like, you know what I mean? I think,
So
even, you know, the best religious people do that. But go on.
Yeah, yeah. No, so for people listening, I think this is a really good takeaway. It's that when you're trying to validate a comedian, you validate them for the ability to point out these contradictions that you didn't. You say something really interesting in the book about, actually, I think you're quoting someone about how comedy is meant to have you stumble over the joke and then realize you stumbled over it. Are you quoting Chow maybe on that?
Where was that?
It's something like that, And that's precisely right, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that was, I think that's that was from a book on Zizek and performance, and that's quite interesting because I think Chow might actually be a stand-up comedian.
Oh, wow, okay, I'll have to read that.
Yeah, who was applying Zizek's ideas, so it was, it's an edited collection, and I think Chow has a chapter in the collection. Yeah, I think it's titled Zizek and Performance, but that's, yeah, and as you said, he highlights a lot of these things about, particularly when doing stand-up comedy, that you're talking to a void, aren't you? Or you're talking to an empty, a room where you can just see nothing, perhaps, when you're on the stage with the lights talking and whatnot. So every joke is a a step into the unknown, I suppose.
Yeah, well, and you basically make the argument that true, we'll call it true discomfort. I mean, true false is like, but it's hard to find better language than that sometimes. That the discomfort that's produced, not because someone said something that legit made you uncomfortable, like an actual racist joke.
No, yeah.
Or a Holocaust joke, which make me very uncomfortable, right? That's not the kind of discomfort we're aiming for. And often that discomfort gets held up as like all discomfort is good. And it's like, no, you're saying that's just cheap discomfort that only some people are uncomfortable. That's the issue. The thing we want is like to basically poke holes in your entire understanding of how reality works. And that's the discomfort that sort of we need to fundamentally use to create collective identity. And it's, and it can be suppressed by political correctness because it allows for no kinds of discomfort because some are damaging and some are productive, but it's too hard to nuance that. So it's just off the board entirely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah. And political correctness is wonderful for that. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I was trying to draw this link between sort of the ideological significance of political correctness, because it works both ways. You can be both for political correctness and against it.
Yes, right.
In the sense that, yeah, in the sense that you can be anti-PC and attack, and therefore be attacking political correctness, but at the same time, you can then be very politically correct and attack the anti-PCers, if that makes sense, people who are anti it. So it's like, it's just this no-win game, really, which to me meant that there must have been something ideological about it that made it.
Do you watch Cameron Esposito stand up at all?
No.
She's really good at this. She is an excellent, I call her a PC comic with every like benefit of that word. I mean, she's the most politically correct, funny person I've ever seen. And it's cool to watch her because she quite explicitly says, I don't need to violate political correctness to be funny. Watch how I'm not going to do that now. So it's, she's really good to watch for something like that. All right. You want to do the analysis of the dead to me and then we'll jump over to The Office?
Yes. Yeah. Cool. So, I mean, just, yeah. So what we were talking about there with regards to actual, you know, this position that those who are politically correct can sort of hold, and this sort of universal position, I think this was one way we were linking it there, with the universal.
Right.
So this is from the Netflix series, Dead to Me. So what I'll do is I'll read out the extract and then I'll read out the script as well. And that's included in the book. So an example of this can be found in the dark comedy Dead to Me. Here, the character Jen, played by Christina Applegate, whose husband has recently been killed in a hit and run, attends a retreat for bereaved spouses. At a karaoke event organized by the retreat, Jen nervously approaches Jason, Steve Howie, with the intended desire to fuck him. Before approaching Jason, Jen exclaims to a friend, I'm going to try and fuck that guy. Clearly nervous and hoping to apologize for a previous offense that she made earlier in the day, Jen remarks that the offense was in fact a lame attempt to try and flirt with Jason. Upon hearing this, Jason remarks that he is flattered that Jen would like to flirt with him, before stating, you're beautiful. Happily shocked by the remark, Jen takes a breath and awkwardly whispers, do you want to fuck? The following ensues. Jason, what did you say? Jen, do you? Jen again mouths the following, which is barely audible. Want to fuck? Jason, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Jen, clearly embarrassed. I'm sorry, would you like to dance? Jason, smiling, oh sure, yeah. Because for a second, I thought that you were asking me if I wanted to fuck. So this short scene effectively demonstrates the underlying impasses and awkward encounters that inevitably proceed when one takes a more open approach to, in this instance, heterosexual seduction. Notably, as is clear in the above example, such forms of open expression, which may in fact reveal the positive assertion of female empowerment, can just as easily work to maintain latent forms of patriarchal power and enjoyment. In the scene, Jen feels guilty, as evident in the whispered assertions, about asking Jason to sleep with her. And while Jason knew all along and clearly enjoyed the fact that Jen wanted to fuck him, he just needed to hear her embarrassingly redeclare it. So I think to me that joke just gets at the heart of the problems with political correctness you've got. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, the whole process of seduction. I mean, it's an example that Zizek, you know, comes back to all the time. He says, well, how can you manage or mitigate the process of, you know, of seduction when it can only work retroactively? You know what
right.
I mean? If you make a pass at somebody and that person's offended by the pass, well, you've offended them. But if they're not offended, then the pass was never offensive, was it? Because retroactively it changes the implication behind it.
Right.
So I think what was quite funny about that, I probably read that horrifically. Go watch Dead to Me would be probably the best suggestion.
Well, Christina Applegate is hysterical. So, I mean,
well, yeah,
that's a high bar. It's a high bar.
Yeah. So So yeah, and she does it brilliantly as well in the way she sort of, she has the embarrassment of offending him and whatnot. But what I thought was quite, and what I thought was quite interesting there was how the joke itself actually was centered around the man in that instance, Jason, you know, deliberately performing, getting her to say, I do want to fuck, and keep repeating it, which I thought was quite interesting, because that was the crux of the matter. And she was embarrassed to ask it. She was nervous, perhaps, to just come out and say that, when clearly that's what was hanging in the air, so to speak.
So to use your language, what's the subversion of the universal and the particular there? Can you lay that out for the listeners?
Okay, so what I would probably say in that instance is so to draw upon the terms that Panjit uses, the concrete universal, and I think the reason why I quite like that is because the universal becomes concretized, it becomes brought to bear in a particular moment, is that you get, if you think there that Jen is trying to be, I don't know, political correctness might not be the right term.
Kind of like she's, demure, sort of?
Yeah, demure, like she's sort of, rather than, rather than just going up, rather than going up to somebody and saying, do you want to fuck?
Like Margaret Cho,
So like, good God, what's wrong with you type thing. She has to sort of whisper it and whatnot. So what you do is you get this whole abstract demure, this notion of demureness, this idea of the way in which she should be,
ladylike behavior.
Ladylike behavior. In this one moment, it gets displayed for all the problems that are inherent to it.
Right.
So it's the universal suddenly now becomes alive in that minute, in the same way that the Baron's title suddenly falls to the ground. There's a wonderful quote, I can't remember if I got it, but there's a brilliant quote by Marcus Pound, who talks about, in talking about Supanjic, again, to bring it back to the Baron example, he says that bad comedy, the heavens come crashing down, but at the end of the day, they're all still there by the end of the comedy, because you can go back to normal. So it's like a bit like the carnival-esque and whatnot. We can all be mad and funny for a couple of minutes, but then everything goes back to normal. As an example, which Simon Critchley draws upon about how it always makes you wonder how these examples come about. But apparently, when he was writing his book on comedy, he was at a hotel, and the hotel had a company come in and do an away day type session. We call them away days, isn't it?
Okay.
Where they all get together, like a bonding session workplace. And they were having to do some, banal activity where you have to make something, usually, don't you, out of matchsticks or straws or something. And he was saying about how they were messing about in the activity, which is one way they tried to subvert it and create a sense of distance.
Right.
But I argue that doesn't really work, does it? Because it just maintains the power structure. You get your 5 minutes of messing about, criticizing the bosses, saying how ridiculous the day is, but then when the activity's over, you still have to go back and do the activity.
Right.
So I think that's, again, why I think this Supanjic example is fantastic, because it shows you, it plays out the inconsistency of the big universal ideological notion. And I think in this example, it was quite a nice one of highlighting how patriarchal power could still, could still exist as well, in the sense that Jason was deliberately teasing her to get that statement out, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I always say to because I teach a stand-up comedy class, and we fight about this all the time, because I'll show them what I consider to be really transgressive comics, and they're like, no, they're not funny. And I'm like, no, they're only not funny because you've been trained to find things that are shitty funny.
Yes.
Because you identify a certain kind of discomfort as funny and another kind of discomfort as not funny. But those are subjective and not, they're just, that's just how you've been trained to respond to the text. But the text itself is doing something different than you're giving it credit for.
Yeah. Right? And that's the performance.
Yeah.
That's the, and I think, the formal elements of that as well, I think, again, there's this relation, this nice relationship between content and form in what we're saying, in the sense that it's the formal structure of the Baron slipping on the banana peel that brings down to earth the contents, shows the ridiculousness of the Baroness, the title. So it's the way in which the formal structure of a joke can highlight the problem with the content or the inconsistencies with the content.
Oh, I love when people talk formed. Talk more form to me. I love it.
Right, we will do when we talk about the office. All right. Well, let's cut to the office. I think, otherwise I'm going to keep alluding to it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. So chapter 5 focuses on the office, the series. I have a bit talking about the series and its significance. There's some wonderful stuff. Interestingly, Paul Gilroy wrote a bit about the office and quite favorably, actually, on David Brent and his reference to the particular joke that I discussed.
Will you remind them who David Brent is?
So David Brent is played by Ricky Gervais. He is the office manager of the office, and he is the stereotypical postmodern boss. He's it's hard to. So we've got it's this noughties period. So it's Tony Blair's New Labour Britain, neoliberal workplaces, 9 to 5, go in and do the office, head into the pub at 5 o'clock. It's awful because it's actually like the precursor to all the worst things that we currently have. So it's like majority of people in that office probably had degrees, you know what I mean?
Right,
but they're not necessarily doing anything with those degrees. Yeah. They've had to go to a normal, you know, 9 to 5 job. So yeah, it really is that sort of, I suppose, that weird period at the start of the new millennium. You know what I mean? It's this weird sort of, I don't know, middle ground period where I think everything, all the problems we now currently have were sort of being born in that instance, perhaps. So I think he's an interesting character. As I said, he draws together all the problems I think that you could tie to neoliberal UK New Labour at that time.
He is in America. If you watch The American Office, he's Steve Carell's character. Okay, so
yes.
All right, good.
Yeah, so I think that's the connection. And I think I suppose just to keep an eye on America there, I think it's very similar. I think the US series and literally copies the first two seasons.
It does. It's really close.
Yeah, which is quite interesting because a lot of people I spoke to said they actually think it gets better after that.
Debatable.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. So I think there might be something similar to this episode. So I talk a bit about The Office, have a little bit there on David Brent, and then I focus on, as you said, a bit of a case study. I explore one episode, which is the first episode of the second season titled Merger. And in particular, I look at four scenes from the episode, which sort of all coalesce around the telling of this black man's cock joke. Should I talk a little bit about the scenes and the first scene and whatnot?
Yeah, whatever you think will help them
see the
book arguments laid out. Yeah.
Fantastic. So as I said, chapter 5 has got these four sections. So the first scene is that it's a short scene that involves Gareth, David Brent and Tim, played by Martin Freeman. And it's the first episode, of the second season where there's two offices merging. So you've got the Slough branch and you've got the Swindon branch, and they're both merging. And those that previously worked at Swindon are now coming to Slough. So David's got to do this welcome event. He's got to do like a bit of a welcome meeting. Mm-hmm. And he's he's always looking at the camera. And I'm not sure if it's similar in the US one, but it's clear that though he works in an office, he would much rather be, you know, a television personality, so to speak, in the sort of reality
TV. It's similar. I do think Gervais cues it better, but he invented it in some ways. So it's like,
yeah. Well, so if there's ever an opportunity to perform for the cameras, David takes it type thing. So obviously he's going to have this welcome meeting with the Swindon branch. And he talks about he's going to do some jokes. And Gareth says to him, what jokes, you know, I've got a joke you can use. And so David says, okay, tell us the joke. And the joke is essentially a game of...
Oh, and real quick, Gareth is the British Dwight. So
yes,
if you've watched the US Office, I'm just trying to keep track of characters. Okay, keep going.
Yeah. Okay, it was played by Mackenzie, someone called Mackenzie. I can't remember. Yeah, it's in the book. And I thought about this actually this morning before I started speaking about this, but the joke involves the British family playing the game 20 questions, where they each, somebody thinks of something and then you've got to get to it within 20 questions. And I think Camilla Parker Bowles starts and what she's thinking of is a black man's cock. And they go through all the questions. So is it bigger than the bread bin? Is it bigger? Can I put it in my mouth? And then the joke is that the Queen comes out and says, is it a black man's cock? So she gets there within like 3 questions. To contextualize that in recent debates surrounding the royal family and Meghan Markle.
Actually, I have thoughts on this, but tell the joke first.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's basically the joke, that the queen gets to it within 3 questions. And obviously, and I say this quite clearly in the book, it's a racist joke. It's, you know, it's working off the stereotype that all black men have large genitalia. But the joke is that the royal family got to it. So the queen got to it within 3 questions. So Gareth tells that to David Brent. They both hysterically laugh, and you've got Tim who sits there quite brilliantly. I think Tim is who's the fella who wrote, he's a big actor now. He's married to the British woman, I think.
The American Tim? That.
Yeah.
The American Tim, I think, is Jim, who is John Krasinski.
That's the one. Yeah, he wrote that film, didn't he? With his S1 house, you know, where the people get you, where the monsters get you. That's it. Yeah, good. Yeah, completely off topic. He's sitting there being you, so it's complete. It's funny. It's funny because I mean, you laugh. You laugh at. I think the camera focuses a lot on Tim's bemoos. Tim doesn't laugh. He looks straight at the camera with that expression where you're like, oh, you know. And as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh god. Okay, and it's clear that you've heard.
Tim is Martin Freeman, right? Who is also pretty big in America. Yes. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he is now. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, Frodo. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the first scene. So then I don't analyze this, but later in the episode, David Brent does his little stand up routine to the new Swindon, and it fails awfully. In fact, I think he tries to tell a disabled joke and it completely and utterly backfires. He tries to make a joke about somebody who's disabled in the company and that completely goes wrong. So then in the second scene, it's like after the welcome meeting and they're having like a few, you know, they're having a drink. In the office, and David Brent stood there and he says, oh, this is the joke I should have told you. And he then recites the Royal Family joke. So clearly he knew it was racist from the first scene because he didn't then repeat it later on.
Yep.
Yeah. But then because he didn't get any laughs, he's then got a group of people and he says, this is what I should have told you. And he retells the joke, Royal Family at Christmas playing 20
and
questions.
And all the people are white, right, in that scene?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. All the people are white. I think you've got one member who's in a wheelchair. So I think there's one woman who's in the wheelchair. So it's a very sort of lad, we call it like lad, you know, very masculine, male domain, so to speak. So it's, yeah. And he starts retelling the joke. And then just before he gets to the punchline, before the Queen says, is it a black man's cock? Oliver, the black colleague, steps into the group. Right. And it's, again, just go on YouTube, type in, I don't know, type in David Brent, black man's cock joke, and you'll see the scene because it's acted phenomenally. And I was able to get permission to reuse the scripts in the book because the script hopefully is where you can get some laughs as well, because it's Oliver steps in and David immediately is like, oh yeah, and just doesn't finish the punchline at all, i.e. Mm-hmm. When she says, is it a black man's cock? So obviously Oliver walks in and it's clear that his presence has altered the telling of the joke. And somebody in the group says, well, all right then, David, what was the joke? What was the punchline? And he goes, oh, that was it. And it's clear that he's awkward. He doesn't want to tell the joke. And Oliver says, you know, what was the joke? And someone says, oh, it's Royal Family. And then Oliver says, oh, the black colleague says, oh, it's not the one about the black man's cock, is it? And so he says the punchline. He's the one who delivers the punchline to the joke, saying, oh, is it the one where it's not a black man's cock? And then what's interesting is that David looks at him and goes, yeah, bad, ain't it? And Oliver turns around and goes, no, no, it's funny. Yeah, it's laughed. So it's this whole awkwardness that gets played out that I think was what The Office did brilliantly. But what's quite unique here is, I think, and it's something we can talk about in a bit, is the sense in which the joke's formal structure is changed in these two scenes.
Right.
Which is, I think where most of our discussion can lie. The third scene, Brent and Gareth are brought into the manager's office where they're reprimanded by the bosses. And you get the joke retold, this time a third time in the scene as well, as they say it to the bosses. And then there's a final fourth scene where David says to the group, you know, who complained? Type thing. And I think this plays upon because David's whole thing about it in the third and fourth scene is that it can't be racist because Oliver found it funny. The black man found it funny.
Which is where it then returns to his
which then again, you know, that's when you see like the real ridiculousness of because David thinks he's being politically correct by telling a racist joke that a black man finds funny type thing. It's that idea. I think that would be that sort of false perversion or whatnot. So it's the first two scenes that I think are particularly funny and particularly interesting. I think they're interesting partly because you see this relationship between the joke and the comedy sequence getting played out in these two scenes. So one of the things Alenka Shapanjic talks about is that jokes have this joke and comedy sequences have a temporality. So when you tell a joke, you create a story, so to speak, and then you have the punchline. And then the punchline retroactively changes everything that came before, type thing. So it sort of redefines the story that was previously being told, and you laugh at the butt, so to speak, the punchline. A comic sequence is different because a comic sequence, what that does is it presents a different temporal perform. In that, what you'll get the same sequence performed But it's a strange sort of continuity in discontinuity. So a comic sequence would be, I mean, the ultimate example of a comic sequence would be mistaken identities, where in the first instance, often the audience know that the identity's been mistaken, but what then you see get played out over the course of the comic sequence is the way in which those mistaken identities create, you know, get worse. And the comic, you know, the comedy is built up over the fact that it's the sequence is being played out, so to speak.
Do you listen to Daniel Sloss at all?
Say that again, sorry.
Daniel Sloss, the British comedian?
No, I've not heard of him. He's
Scottish.
Right.
He does this. His stand-ups are really long, and they revisit the same joke 4 or 5 times by the end. It's a similar kind.
Okay, so that sounds like Stuart. Have you heard of Stuart Lee?
Yeah, Stuart Lee, similar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they're masters at he'll even tell you what you're going to find funny first sentence of the joke, and then proceeds to show you why you're finding it funny all the while you're laughing.
It appeals to the comedy nerd in me. I really like comics that explain why things are funny. Like Gervais does it, but he often will mis-explain his own joke to make something offensive funny, which I find very interesting because I think he's smarter than that, but maybe he's not. I don't know.
Yeah. He punches down, I suppose.
He's a punch downer for sure. And it's gotten, I think this is true of like, as people age, especially I think like privileged people, like white men, they get older and suddenly like the norms change. So things that were funny in the 80s aren't funny now. And instead of just realizing why that might be and writing new jokes, they just continue to defend jokes from 30 years ago. Right.
So he ends up hosting the Globes with a pint of beer there because he's everyday working man.
Yeah, with jokes he's been telling for 20 years that don't work anymore. Yeah. Okay, tell me more. Sorry, I digress.
That's fine. And so, Stuart Lee's perfect. Again, highlighting that comic sequence and the way. And I could have written a whole book on Stuart Lee. The worst thing was, I think someone, Berlant and the guy, I probably said those names awfully, they're cited in the book. They did a fantastic chapter, paper where they explored Stuart Lee, which was really good. So I left that one there. So I think what's really interesting here is what you get in these first two scenes is you get the merging of both a joke and a comedy sequence. So you get the telling of a norm. So it's like a joke within a joke within a weird way as well. You're getting told a joke within that first scene, which is a joke. And, you know, you could have had that first scene and that would have been a perfect example of racism because all you would have been told was a racist joke with nothing to follow up, nothing to come of it. 3 white men being told a racist joke, 2 men finding it hilarious. But then what's quite interesting is that the way in which the following scenes then continue with the joke. And I think it's then that it starts to take on a level of subversion. And I think this is really something which is brought to bear, as I said, there in the presence of Oliver. So whereas I think one of the things that, you know, the 4 and in particular this episode does really well is it shows the connection between jokes and a comic sequence. But what it also shows is how the position of telling the joke can change as well. And this is what I referred to earlier between the subject of enunciation. So that's the position from which a joke is told. And then the subject of enunciated, which is the content of a joke as well. So I think this is quite interesting because I think what you get, particularly in the second scene, is the fact that you get this switch in it. So I think what's quite nice is that the actual content of the joke appears formally as a presence in the second scene. So you get Oliver, the black man, and his black cock suddenly appear. So it's no longer just a joke anymore. He's there within the reality of this comic sequence, which is itself, you know, which is itself a joke as well. Because you instantly laugh, or you instantly go, oh, you know, the second Oliver enters the scene type of thing. Because you know what's coming. You know, you've already, this is what I mean about the discontinuity in the comic sequence. You've already heard the joke. You know what's going to be said. But there's this added addition that sort of gets included. But I think what's quite nice is it's already included because it's already included in the first scene in the content of the joke, if that makes sense. So I think what's interesting here is these two scenes are playing with this relationship between content and form. And you get Oliver occupy this position of enunciation, and he's the one that gets to finish the punchline, which is really interesting. So I think, you know, with Oliver finishing the racist joke, it's clear that he occupies the place of enunciation and the subject of the enunciated.
Right.
So I think he's in both relationships here to both the content of the joke, but then also the position of the joke teller. Mm-hmm. So you get this subversion. I think the easiest way to sort of conceptualize this in our discussion would be David's authority gets subverted in that instance. You know, right. He's no longer the position of authority, i.e. the joke teller. He sort of gives up on that role, and it's taken over by the joke's punchline, literally, by the black man, if that makes sense. So I think what's interesting here is one thing I say, it's not just that Oliver resides within the joke's content, he is a black man, but that rather than being excluded from the joke's performance, it is through Oliver's recounting of the punchline that a shift, i.e. an exposition of the inherent gap, is achieved. So I think that's the way in which it brings home the inconsistency, the gap in the sort of the politically correct demeanor, so to speak, of David Brent gets concretized. You know, David, the reason why David's not, he's not saying the joke is because he knows it's wrong. He knows it's racist. He's right, trying to maintain right. that politically correct image. But it's only in through the case of Oliver that we get to see that subverted. So in a paradoxical way, I say Oliver's place of enunciation reveals the gap within the enunciated content, with his own intentions and the joke's political incorrectness being called into question.
I think I explain
this in the book as well, where I say, like, there's two ways that could go. You know, you either Oliver enters and the joke gets told by David, which would just be awkward because you'd hear it would be a group of white people telling a racist joke in front of a black man. You either don't say it, you either stop completely. So imagine if David just went like, no, there was no joke. You know, if anyone tried to say anything, shut up, don't say anything. I mean, that's like entering a room with people talking about you, and it's the most awkward thing in the world. I mean, that would be even worse.
Right.
To me, I think that would be like even more violent against Oliver, the fact that his presence clearly just stopped the joke being told. So again, like, what I like about this scene and the way in which I think it brings to bear the false universality of political correctness and the ridiculousness of political correctness is that it performs the joke. But in this play, in this instance, Oliver becomes the joke teller, so to speak. And then that's just something, the failure of David to realize that is then something that gets played out in scenes 3 and 4. So you get the continuation of this
failure. Right, if it had stopped there, it might have just been another case of like white privilege being authorized by, you know, coerced black consent. And now it's, no, well, let's keep going on this because it needs to be clear that Oliver becoming both positions doesn't then like turn back into just things we've seen before, right? We have to keep pushing the boundary of the joke.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And in the end, I think it even goes beyond the racism of the joke. So I think in the third scene, you know, Gareth sits there, who's the Dwight character, and he's like, you know, Jennifer, they are, you know, black men do have big penises. I can show you, I've got magazines. And she's like, really? Do you, honest to God, do you have magazines? Like, he can't even see the ridiculousness of how he's digging himself into a deeper hole. You get then, as they're leaving, David then makes a homophobic faux pas as well in his discussion with the manager. So then that includes other things. It's almost like he can't stop himself after that. So all you get is this continuation of the ridiculousness of political correctness being played out through its own inconsistencies and, you know, its own inherent comedy, I suppose, would be the clear line there. But yeah, I think Oliver's attempts to hear the joke's punchline, I think it deliberately draws upon the idiosyncrasy of the joke. So it's that obscene enjoyment that, you know, in the racist joke, which gets played out.
And I think too, one of the reasons that this joke works in this scene, I was thinking about it, is that it's not only a joke on race, it's also a joke on like propriety, which of course, if there's one, right, that's kind of what British comedy is exceptionally good at. If you think about Monty Python, it's poking fun at class norms. It's kind of one of the differences between the US and, like, since we don't have a royal class, we still have class issues. Comedy about propriety doesn't quite work because we're a low propriety culture anyway.
Yeah.
But the fact that the queen gets the joke so quickly is actually the joke fundamentally is a joke about upending assumptions about the royal family.
Yes.
But it uses racial stereotypes to make the class joke. And so it's really complicated in terms of the fact that it is a racist joke, but it's not only a racist joke because most jokes have multiple layers and they use one to play against the other.
Yes. Yeah.
So in this case, the more times you hear the joke, the more different ways you can see it poking at social structures, not just race, but then it becomes class, then it becomes femininity, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's almost like And I suppose this is one thing, this is something that Todd McGowan talks a lot about in relation to comedy, about the relationship between lack and excess. It's that sort of excessive enjoyment that always seems to bubble out. So, you know, after Oliver said, no, the joke's funny, and let David off the hook, so to speak, he then looks at the group of people in front of him and says, oh, have you met this little lady? And she's a little lady because she's in a wheelchair.
Right.
So it's like he can't help it. And that's what he then plays out in the third scene and in the fourth scene as well. The fourth scene's a good one. He sort of, that's where he stands up and says, you know, who complained about the joke? It turns out it's a white woman. And he's like, well, Oliver didn't find it funny. Did you, Oliver? Like, you know what I mean? And it all comes to a head, and he talks about melting pots. So it's even like, he even talks about the sort of very rather false multicultural language of new labor multiculturalism in that sense, the melting pot, bringing everybody together. Mm-hmm. He talks about wanting half and half. And it's just, as I said, he just digs himself this deeper hole where it's his political correctness, which you're laughing at, I think, which is key. And you're laughing at David in that sense. He's a true comedy character, I argue, in that instance.
Yeah. And again, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. But that link you made there with Monty Python, as I said, is a real interesting one. I mean, I find the scenes of Monty Python, there are certain scenes which are hilarious and formally very good as well. But I mean, it's a group of Oxbridge men, you know what I mean? Again, pointing down and making, I think a lot of people in the UK struggle with it, especially today. I mean, you've got John Cleese, who's essentially a nutter now, isn't he? The way he sort of comes out.
Well, and I think it's I think things have to be read in their context. And I don't think Monty Python, in fact, John Cleese gives an amazing eulogy for Graham Chapman that I used to teach speech writing. But in the middle of it, he talks about all of these horrible things that Chapman used to do to women, like crawl around like a dog and sniff their ankles. I mean, things that are just very out of, and I have to tell them, look, like there are other speech. I mean, we don't just use white men, obviously that's important, but it's such a textbook good speech. And then we just have to talk about the fact that, like, look, it's the same thing with The Office. I mean, you can do a close read of this scene because it's so interesting and not then apologize for the broader Office, which in most cases just authorizes white privileged entitled, right? It makes Ricky Gervais a sympathetic character when he should have been fired.
No,
that's kind of what bothers everybody about The Office, but it was also the 90s. And
So I think it's all complicated. Yeah, and I think that's something that hopefully the book tries to get across. It's, and I think you mentioned it there, it's that formal, it's the formal structure key, I think, there, the form. And this is something that I think I mentioned to you before, that Matthew Flis-Fleder does brilliantly in his Algorithmic Desire. He wrote a lovely review for the book, and he says about its structures that aren't total and like whole, but the actual structures are based upon their own inconsistency, which gives body to the structure. It's their own contradictions. And I think that's one thing that this sort of formal analysis does really well, is it highlights the inconsistencies, the problems in false forms of universality, such as political correctness and those sort of associated ideologies.
Like comedians of color emerge on the scene. Amanda Seales is excellent. Dulce Sloan is really good. You're seeing new, unfortunately for a long time, only white men were doing the comedy. And so you had to work within a certain frame. So Ricky Gervais was the most progressive comic at the time, because other than, you didn't see black women comics in the 90s. I mean, there were a few, but they were not popular. And now you do have other choices. So no one's saying this is the only way to do subversive comedy, but for its time and the popularity of The Office, it's a very important set of jokes to analyze, right?
No, definitely. And there was, I mean, I'm going to say, I don't want to get his second name wrong, but Daniel, you know, the lad, the British actor, fantastic, great British actor. The
From
black
Harry
lad
Potter?
He's in the Jordan Peele film, Get Out. Is it,
Daniel Kaluuya.
And he does an SNL. He hosted SNL, I think, for you guys on Saturday. And his
open
monologue.
SNL. Maybe I'll go back to it.
Right. Okay. Well, if you can get this, just what you'll catch it on Twitter. It's only about 3 minutes. But in his open monologue, he talks about someone. He says, you know, people say to me, which is worse, black UK racism or American racism? And he says, well, the problem with UK racism was that it was so bad, they had to go to other countries to create racist societies. So you get like, and it's obviously he delivers it and it's funny. But so you get this whole, so he's this idea, well, racism was that bad in the UK that even white people in the UK couldn't stomach it. We had to go to Australia, New Zealand.
We had to
colonize the rest of the world in order to create better forms of racism. And then again, I thought, you know, this whole position of the teller, the content, the way in which he's absurd it around there, around the notion of bad racism, like he's performing, you know, he's in the position of a bad racism by saying, well, you know, the UK's worse, that's why we had to go abroad and create even worse racism type thing. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think he brings it to light quite nicely there, some of these contradictions.
Well, I mean, I really enjoyed the book. I think the analysis is excellent. It really gets you thinking. And again, I mean, what is funny is always subjective. So I always play clips for people because structurally, the comedy is really well done or poorly done. And it's good to see those contrasts. And then people will say, well, that was funny. It wasn't funny. And it's like, well, yeah, but your reaction to whether something is funny is different than the argument about how it moves. So you can totally agree with all the moves and still come away and say, this isn't a funny joke.
No,
right?
Of course.
So yeah, you may watch The Office and not find it funny, but I just want to be clear. Yeah. Nobody's telling you what to find funny. We're just telling you that as analysts, we're looking at style and form and trying to make some arguments.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I think when it lays bare the contradictions, that's when we're in. And like you said, you know, I've been showing this joke in seminars and lectures for about 5 years. And it's amazing how you can, 1 year can find it hilarious, another year, like
precisely.
The room's stone cold. And you probably, that's what you were getting at earlier. And you're like,
I show a Chris Rock bit to a group of people for a professional development seminar last year, and they hated it. And people in my classes love those jokes.
Yes. No.
And then I played it for them, and it was like, "This is disgusting. Why are you playing this?" And I was I better rethink my audience next time. You know.
Right. Yeah.
The book is excellent. The theory laid out is really accessible. If for anybody looking on a fun psychoanalysis read, I really enjoyed it. I don't always enjoy people who use psychoanalysis. It's kind of dense, but the fact that it was laid out so clearly and led up to this rather like large case study was really enjoyable. So, do you want to? So, I can't recommend the book enough. Sorry, it's after we hit an hour, my tongue starts to get twisty. And I just want to once again say we've been talking to Jack Black, author of Race, Racism, and Political Correctness in Comedy from Routledge 2021. So before we wrap, Jack, what else have you got on the plate? And you want to say anything else before I tell people how they can get a copy of the book?
No. So what am I, I'm working on, well, I say that, no. I'm working on another book at the minute. This one's on belief. I'm trying to draw upon Robert Fowler's notion of interpassivity. So I think it takes some of the ideas I explore here, particularly I think it's going to extend a little bit more on the relationship between subversion and perversion, and how belief can be. I don't think we have enough belief, perhaps. We don't have impossible beliefs at the minute, which is something that the book's going to be looking at. We've lost impossible beliefs. We don't believe in the impossible anymore. So I think that's one thing that the book's going to be looking at.
Great. I'm excited. So we have a future book interview slated. As soon as you finish it, you let me know.
Yeah. Well, hopefully by me saying it, that means I'll definitely get it finished.
You've committed to six to 9,000 people that you're going to write this book. So they're all eagerly awaiting. Don't forget them as you're writing.
Well, thank you.
All right. And just a reminder, everyone, if you are not interested in grabbing a copy for yourself, one of the very cool things you can do is ask your local library to purchase a copy, whether that's university or city library. But again, budgets are tight right now. So even better if you can buy them a copy so that this can stay on the shelves for lots of people to read for decades to come. It's a great way to recognize the work being done, get it out to more people, and keep presses like Routledge and the New Books Network up and running, because most of this stuff is not done for a very big profit. Academics make almost no money on our books. Presses make almost no money. And New Books Network is entirely volunteer. So something nice you can do if you would like. Other than that, Jack, if anybody wants to reach out and chat or learn more about you, where's the best place to send them?
Twitter. I'm on Twitter. So I think Jack St. Black or my email address would probably be there. Yeah. Do I need to say that? Is that going to be included or?
You can if you want. Otherwise, they can just
J.Black. Yeah, just Google. Yeah, if you Google me, you'll see me on there. That's always a bit, yeah.
All right, wonderful. Yeah, well, yeah, so no, we love to start dialogues. I mean, so if you're listening, have thoughts, have comments, reach out to us. You can find me on social media and on Gmail at rhetorically, like always. And it would be great to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and mask up. Thank you so much.